The story is as old as the amphitheater. Girl meets boy from a rich and powerful family. Boy marries girl. Man cheats, gets caught. Woman divorces man. Woman gets even. The new novel, Queen Takes King, is the latest variation on that theme from Gigi Levangie-Grazer. Her first book, The Starter Wife, became a TV series. A second novel, Maneater, became a Lifetime miniseries. But this new one moves from the hills of Hollywood to the avenues of Manhattan. Gigi is in our New York bureau. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Why move location from the known territory of Beverly Hills to Park Avenue?
You know, I was, let me just be frank, I was tired of Hollywood. I was just tired of it. After I had written two books about, actually three, my first one was Rescue Me, but that was a more serious take on coming-of-age story in Los Angeles.
Uh-huh.
My second and third one dealt with Hollywood and its environs. And when I was done with those, I felt that I was done with Hollywood itself in that, you know, I'd go to a 500-person valet party for Easter, and I couldn't write about it anymore.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I just didn't have it in me.
Exhausted.
The satire was exhausted, and so it was stone cold reality, and I was finished. Mm-hmm. And we moved. My husband at the time, moved to New York. He had to make a movie, and I thought, why not choose this time to delve into New York and society there.
You moved to New York with your then husband. Your then husband,
yes.
And is Hollywood producer Brian Grazer?
I call Brian. I love him. I call him my husband because I think that sounds nicer.
Oh,
doesn't it?
That's what you have your character calling her.
Yes.
Husband, the husband.
The husband, not the ex.
Okay, now go back to the time when it wasn't as you weren't as nice to one another, and
oh,
you began to write when you broke up. Was there a line between personal and private? Were there things about that relationship that you considered verboten as inspiration for fiction?
Oh, that's so interesting because people assume that I wrote The Starter Wife when we had trouble in our marriage, and that wasn't true at all.
Mm.
Because, as you know, The Starter Wife is about divorce in Los Angeles, a
mm-hmm.
powerful couple breaking up. This was long before we had any, you know, I mean, I'm sure there was an inkling probably more on his side than mine, but I didn't know that we were going to break up. I just had this character in mind.
Oh.
And I guess I always did. I'd have girls' nights at my house, and I could see that other women really wanted to be in the position of the producer's wife. I mean, I loved Brian, but I could see what they wanted. They wanted the setting, the garden, the
mm.
staff,
mm-hmm.
you
mm-hmm.
know.
Mm-hmm.
I was not really, that's not my orientation.
Mm-hmm.
I feel that it's much more important to do what you want in life, to find your own way. I come from generations of women who worked, and in some cases the husbands didn't. So I come from a very powerful line of a matriarchal society.
Yeah.
So I don't relate. I didn't relate to Brian on that level.
Do you see this as a product almost? It's kind of a guilty pleasure, a little like soap opera and paperback romance novels. Even this Queen Takes King. I mean, it's,
uh-huh.
you know, it's, you're reading it and it's like, you know, it keeps going. It's a page turner.
Mm-hmm. Well, with all my books, except for probably Maneater. Maneater, I just knew this character. And I had seen her. I had seen her in a composite of different women in L.A. I saw how they went after men. And one woman I know had already planned her wedding without the groom. And then she picked the groom to fit what she had in mind for the wedding.
Mm.
And I hadn't grown up with people like this. I mean, I grew up, you know, sort of quote-unquote on the wrong side of the tracks. And in fact, my father wouldn't even let me step foot in Beverly Hills because he thought I'd be arrested because I didn't have any money. I wasn't wearing the right clothes and that sort of thing. Beverly Hills terrified me. I feel like I'm a person and still I have issues with it. Who is on the outside looking in. And so it's not just a group of, you know, a gaggle of girls with their designer dresses and everything. What makes them tick? That's what interests me. I mean, I'm a girl. I've been reading. I read Dear Abby from the time I was 6 years old. People's problems interest me. Human interest stories consume me. It's not just the action. It's what happened beforehand. Especially with Queen Takes King, I wanted to write a love story about the nature of love and how you can fall in love and it changes everything in your life. And in fact, there are chemical changes in your brain that happen when you're in the state of infatuation. It's a drugged state. And I wanted to write about that. But of course, what happens with me, and this is what happens in my life, is I can't help but make it funny. And that's just who I am. I mean, I can have... There have been tragic moments in my life, and if I wait long enough, it becomes a joke. Mm-hmm. And that's how I deal with life.
Gigi Lavangi-Grazer's new novel is Queen Takes King. It's published by Simon & Schuster, and she joined us from New York. Thanks a lot. Good luck with this.
Thank you so much, Leanne.
Later today, the U.S. soccer team plays an improbable game against the mighty Brazilians in the finals of the Confederations Cup. It's being held in South Africa, and it's kind of a tune-up for next year's World Cup there. But the tune that viewers will hear is the loud buzz of the vuvuzela, a plastic horn. NPR's Mike Pesca brings the noise.
The sounds of soccer are foreign to most U.S. ears. The great Brazilian's name is pronounced Kaká. The Spanish midfielder, who was somehow vanquished in the last round by the Americans, spells his name X-A-V-I, but you say it Xavi. Then there is this sound. When sold in America, they're called stadium horns. In South Africa, vuvuzela. They're all the buzz at the Confederations Cup, providing the score for every score, but also for every pass, pause, and substitution. Television networks throughout the world ask that soccer's governing body, FIFA, ban them. South Africans were appalled, claiming they were a legitimate expression of their culture. In order to let you decide, I will keep the sound running for the next few minutes of this report. Okay, I have been asked to stop. But when reporters asked Sepp Blatter if he could stop the vuvuzela, the FIFA president issued this spirited defense of the instrument.
I have always said when we come to Africa and to South Africa for a World Cup, there will be other noises than you have generally. And now you have the woo-woo-woo-woo-woo-woo-woo. You have all that. You have all that.
Blatter knew that it would be seen as neo-imperialist if he were to ban an instrument said to have derived from the kudu horn. To Grant Wall, who has been covering the Confederations Cup for Sports Illustrated, the vuvuzela is more a noisemaker than an instrument. They produce a noise he likens to
a million bees suddenly in your ear.
Wall says you never really get used to the vuvuzela, but you put up with it. Though not all the athletes were so understanding.
Xabi Alonso, the Spanish midfielder, had a different idea, though. He complained bitterly about the vuvuzelas and said it really affected the way he played, and he hoped they were gone for 2010.
Instead, it is Alonso who is gone from the current competition. The vuvuzelas seem to have won the day. But serious questions remain. I put those questions directly to a vuvuzela. First of all, thank you for joining me. Can I call you Vuvu? Okay. What do you say to critics who worry that this afternoon's game would be a great opportunity to get Americans interested in soccer, but if potential fans tune into the game, they'll be put off by the incessant background noise? Well, it is noise. How can you say it's music? Well, I stand corrected. For the Vuvuzela, this is Mike Pesca, NPR News, New York.
This is NPR News. President Obama has come out with a plan to overhaul our system of financial oversight, designed to keep banks from imploding and putting the economy at risk. American presidents have been there before. Our Planet Money team takes a look back at financial regulation through the ages. Here are Alex Blumberg and Hannah Jaffe-Walt.
This is great. It'll be a quick, exciting tour of crisis, despair, redemption, and then crisis again.
I think I've been on this tour with my family when I was a kid.
Yeah, but this one goes back in time, Alex. It'll be fun. There's music. Come on, let's start. It's 1907, and there is a panic.
Wait, Hannah, he's about to start singing.
A Okay, 1907, the U.S. is facing a serious economic crisis. Interest rates are soaring, there are bank runs, and people start saying, hey, shouldn't we have some sort of public administration to help us with these panics? We have them all the time.
So we created the Federal Reserve. It would hopefully keep money circulating, prevent bank runs, and be there as a last resort if banks get into trouble.
Yes, President Woodrow Wilson, 1913, he signs the Federal Reserve Act and says this. You won't hear his voice here. It's historian Andrew Wender Cohen reading his words.
And the control of the system of banking and of issue which our new laws are to set up must be public, not private, must be vested in the government itself so that the banks may be the instruments, not the masters of business and of individual enterprise and initiative.
Banks are not the masters. It's a timeless phrase.
So panic 1907 gives us the Federal Reserve, and then we're solid, Alex, until things fall apart again.
They used to tell me I was building a dream with peace and glory ahead. Why should I be standing in line just waiting for bread?
I know this one, the Great Depression.
Runs on banks, crazy unemployment, things get really bad. So, time for a president to add some more regulation. This time, FDR.
Your government does not intend that the history of the past few years shall be repeated. We do not want and will not have another epidemic of bank failures.
Things sure do sound a lot more ironic when you're listening to them from the future, don't they?
Yeah, but the Great Depression did give us two things. Number one, the FDIC.
Everyone mostly loved that. Their deposits were insured.
And we still do. People generally think that right there is an example of effective reform. Now, it was part of the Glass-Steagall Act, which also gave us the second thing. It said investment banking could not be the same as the banking of consumers.
So, Hannah, we're only at the Great Depression. How long is this tour?
Okay. Just remember that Glass-Steagall, regular folk banking, separate from speculative banking. Okay, next stop.
Wow, we made it all the way to my senior year of college without a financial panic.
Yep, it is 1989. We are in the middle of the savings and loan crisis. So, Alex, we're moving fast through this. Before Madonna, there were a couple important changes. Earlier in the decade, we loosened up on the way we regulate home mortgages. And then in the late 80s, early 90s, more than 700 savings and loans failed.
So we add regulation.
Right. President Bush gets rid of the regulator for savings and loans and replaces it with a new agency, the Office of Thrift Supervision. He trashes one regulator, puts in place another.
Never again will America allow any insured institution to operate normally if owners lack sufficient tangible capital to protect depositors and taxpayers alike.
Man, again with the never again. We've heard that a lot on our tour, haven't we? It's a pretty confident statement.
Yeah, well, we did get pretty confident after this. Some might say overconfident.
I know this is a banking crowd, but you don't have to be stiff. Relax here. Have a good time.
That's President Bill Clinton making a little joke about stiff bankers right before he signs the Graham-Leach-Bliley Act in 1999.
If crisis adds regulation, good economic times like with President Clinton tend to do the opposite. The Graham-Leach-Bliley Act, which Clinton is signing here, undid that law from the 1930s that said investment banks and commercial banks had to operate separately.
So there's not a lot of never again rhetoric here. It's more like, look how far we've come. We don't need that old Glass-Steagall law from the 1930s that President Roosevelt passed.
It is true that the Glass-Steagall law is no longer appropriate to the economy in which we lived. It worked pretty well for the industrial economy, which was highly organized, much more centralized, and much more nationalized than the one in which we operate today. But the world is very different.
And Hanna, a lot of people, including President Obama, point to this moment where President Clinton is signing this bill as being a key step in getting us where we are today. Companies merged and got huge. Of course, other economists argue that it's not that clear.
Yeah. So speaking of today.
Just dance. Oh, hello. Hello. Yes. And here we are in the present.
Okay. Yes. Here we are. Crisis number whatever. Mr. Obama wants to now reshape regulation in the mold of this crisis. He's calling for tighter regulation of large financial firms. He wants a way for the Federal Reserve to take over enormous companies. And he wants a consumer protection agency and he would like to get rid of the Office of Thrift Supervision.
The agency that we heard President Bush creating 20 years ago.
All right, I think that brings us up to date. The end of our tour, ladies and gentlemen.
Please feel free to tip your tour guides on the way out. My name again, Alex Bloomberg.
Or wait, Hannah Jaffe Walt, NPR News.
You're listening to Weekend Edition from NPR News. This weekend, Miramax Films released its new movie, Cherie, about a woman who is winding down a long and illustrious career as a prostitute. The film is set in Paris at the turn of the 19th century, during the lavish period known as the Belle Époque. And as the narrator tells us, the ladies of leisure of this era were no ordinary call girls.
There was Emilienne d'Alençon, who fancied herself as an actress, but was better known as the woman who'd all but bankrupted King Leopold II of Belgium. There was Leanne de Pougy, who, when shown 1.5 million francs worth of jewels by her lover of the moment, became paralyzed with indecision, thus obliging him to buy her the entire display. She later became a nun.
And the list goes on. These were real women. More about Leanne in a moment. But Lea, the main character in the movie played by Michelle Pfeiffer, is fictional. The film is based on a 1920 novel, Cherie, written by Colette. Cherie is directed and narrated by Stephen Frears, who in 1988 was behind the lens for the film Dangerous Liaisons, which also featured Michelle Pfeiffer, and he's in our London studio. Welcome to the program.
Hello.
First, I really want to mention the courtesan, the real one, Leanne de Pougy, whom you mentioned at the beginning. I'm actually named after her.
Congratulations. Or commiseration, one or the other.
I guess it is. I always ask my mother, where did you get the spelling of my name, L-I-A-N-E?
Yes.
And she said, oh, I read it in in the paper. And Leanne de Pougy died in 1950 when she was pregnant with me. So I've always thought, I bought her a biography. So I thought, you kind of skated over her a little bit, but I'll allow it.
How distinguished up for you.
Yeah, I guess. Does this mean I become a nun at the end of my career? And I've never seen that many jewels in my life. But enough about me. Let's talk about your movie. For our listeners who haven't seen it yet, is it possible to just give us just a brief kind of thumbnail synopsis of the new film, Cherie?
Well, these courtesans lived extraordinary lives. They were very, very rich women. They were, like sort of movie stars, really. Except that they kept to their own world very much. And as you said, Michelle Pfeiffer plays a woman at the end of her career, but who's persuaded by her friend to look after her and to educate and to have a relationship with her son, with whom she rather unexpectedly falls in love.
That's the gist of it.
And, yes.
And there's pain, there's sex, and there's great costumes.
Well, it's both frivolous and tragic at the same time.
That's it. There's a duality there.
Yes.
I mean, we're looking at the sumptuous scenes of these beautiful couches and all of this. But underneath, there's this current of blackness, maybe?
Well, people don't stop being human, do they?
No.
No matter how pretty the clothes are.
But it seems particularly poisonous during this time.
Well, it was a decadent time, and of course it all came to an end with the First World War, just as the wealthy times we've lived through have come to an end now.
What was it that attracted you to the project? I mean, it's a Colette story, and you almost can't go wrong with that. But on the other hand, you've done these costume dramas before, Dangerous Liaisons, to connect.
Well, I'm very, very lucky in that I'm introduced to French literature by Christopher Hampton, who wrote the script of Dangerous Liaisons and this script. Mm-hmm. So it's always filtered through this extremely witty surface that he constructs. So I read his script and liked it very much, and then I read the book and liked that very much. So I had a good introduction.
And then it was a matter of colouring in.
Yes.
I read an interview with you in the New York Times, and I was surprised. You say you direct with your ears. What do you mean by that?
You can hear conviction in people's voices. You can hear when people believe what they're saying. You can hear when they hit the right notes. you can more hear conviction than you can see it.
What
you see is whether actors hit their right marks and things like that, but what you hear is the truth.
Well, let's actually listen to a little bit of dialogue between Leah, played by Michelle Pfeiffer, and Cherie, played by Rupert Friend, after they shared their first kiss.
I'm not sure that was very intelligent.
What? Oh, you think I've never kissed a handsome mouth before? You think that's going to make me lose control? I mean, even if we were to, not that I can see that happening.
Well, you raised the subject.
Let's say no more about this, shall we?
And if they said no more about it, there wouldn't be a movie, would there?
Absolutely, absolutely.
But there is, again, one can hear, there's the surface line.
Yes.
And then there's the tension underneath.
Of course, of course. And that's what, it was a very difficult film to make because you were trying to find that the whole time. Mm-hmm. Do you play the surface, do you play the underneath?
Right.
And of course you have to do both.
You do, and the audience has to be in mind of both.
Yes.
Which of the characters do you think needs this relationship more? Leah, who's a woman who's so used to being beautiful and desirable, but now she's getting on, or Cherie, who's this, you know, flippity young playboy, but is really lost.
I couldn't answer that question. I would have thought they both needed it.
It does seem so, doesn't it?
Yes,
yes. But it's Cherie's mother, played by Kathy Bates, that seems to throw the two together.
Yes, without quite... You can't work out what's in her mind.
Oh, she's a...
She's a shocker.
She is a shocker. She's Cherie's mother. She's a retired courtesan herself.
Yes.
And it's just, I think we should let our listeners hear just a little bit of her.
You're getting him back in very good condition. I've kept him away from opium and cocaine and the cheapest sort of drink. I believe you'll find he's a credit to both of us.
I'm sure.
Doesn't mean that little girl's going to be able to handle him.
Young women have their methods.
You may be right. I can't say I remember.
You smell so good.
Don't you find now the skin's a little less firm? It holds perfume so much better.
Yes, Kathy Bates is a real piece of work in this character.
Yes, she's the most magnificent actress.
Yes.
She should be on Mount Rushmore, I always think.
Why is the relationship between Leah and Charlotte, Cherie's mother, so important to the story?
Well, because in a sense, the root of the boy's problems is that the mother was rather neglectful. So in a way, she's asking Michelle's character to do what she had failed to do as a mother.
Hmm.
So, as it were, maternalness is central to it all.
And Michelle Pfeiffer's character, Leah, becomes a one-woman rehabilitation center?
Absolutely. That's what we're all looking for.
And it's so interesting that 20 years ago, you were directing her...
Yes.
In another French drama.
That's right.
Do you feel like it was like chapter two of your relationship?
No, I just think we were all children when we made Liaison. were like, children allowed into the garden.
I wonder if Michelle Pfeiffer ever talked to you about that. I mean, she doesn't strike me as a woman who is worried about aging.
She was very, very courageous about her. And she made no attempt to conceal anything. She wasn't whispering to the cameraman or talking to the makeup people or anything like that. She just wanted to give a good performance, and if that meant looking her age, so be it.
Mm.
As a man, I spend my time kicking and screaming and moaning about how old I am. I think men handle it far worse than women.
I would not have thought that.
I could see that the moment of acceptance is very painful. But then all the women around me become very, very cheerful and they stop flapping about their appearance the whole time. I imagine it's a great weight off their mind.
Yeah. Do you mind if I ask how old you are?
I'm 68.
Oh, you're still young.
It doesn't feel that way.
Is there something else, anything else you'd like to say about the film?
No,
that you'd
not
want
at
it,
all. No, except that it makes me laugh a lot and makes me cry. I don't know what more there is in life.
That sounds like a good movie. It makes you laugh, it makes you cry.
Yes.
Stephen Frears is the director of the new movie Cherie, starring Michelle Pfeiffer. It was released in theaters this weekend, and he joined us from our London bureau. Mr. Frears, thanks so much.
It's been a pleasure.
While American soldiers pull back in Iraq, the toll is still being felt back home. Take Salem, New Hampshire. That's where Staff Sergeant Edmund Lowe grew up and where friends and family are mourning the soldier. He was killed while taking apart a roadside bomb in Iraq. New Hampshire Public Radio's Cheryl Rich Kern has this remembrance.
Edmund Lowe was the second to youngest in a family of six. His parents emigrated from Hong Kong, became U.S. citizens, and opened a computer shop. Ed's mother is a petite woman who moves as if in a whisper, but her small dark eyes reveal an inner strength, especially when she talks about her son.
He's the kind of man that's willing to sacrifice. Even he knows that's a dangerous job, but he has really strong will, really determined to do what he thinks is right to do.
Ed's sister, Selma Dayak, scrolls through her brother's emails.
These are the ones you're just so silly.
Selma opens a photo of her brother in front of an army truck. He's standing on one foot. It's his running man pose.
He's been goofy. He's always been goofy. He's always make us laugh.
Ed liked to make funny faces, but he also knew when to be serious.
He was a quiet leader. There's no flashy about him.
That's Chief Thomas Puzo of Salem High's ROTC program.
People knew when he was in charge of something, they said, okay, Ed, we'll follow you and we'll get this done.
The chief says Ed was a top student and turned down a scholarship to the Rochester Institute of Technology.
You know, I said, Ed, you know, what an opportunity. And he says, well, you know, I don't know. I says, kind of the Army, it's something I want to do.
Justin Ingaharo was an ROTC freshman when Ed was sergeant. Justin says Ed was the one with the book smarts, always ready to help with homework.
Even if you didn't know what you were talking about, you didn't need to know what subject you were doing, even if he's never heard of it, he'd go, well, let's see what we got in the book. And he'd crack it open and try to figure it out with you.
But Justin says that Ed was a kid at heart, like when he created puppet characters with his fingers.
And we were doing the little hand puzzles going, wah, 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 you know, doing little funny stuff. And when we did that for like a half hour in their driveway, and every car going by like staring at us, what are these guys like dancing in the driveway for?
Chief Puzo said Ed took on a dangerous mission when he decided to work with bombs.
But I look at it from one perspective is he's there knowing that if they deal with the situation, in this case it was an explosive device they discovered, then he knows he's going to save lives. You know, but it takes a certain type of person that can do that.
Nick Thompson grew up riding bikes with Ed. Now he finds himself visiting Ed's parents, standing outside their computer shop, trying to grasp the news.
People see his death and that he died in uniform, and not, he shouldn't only be remembered for how he died, but he should rather be remembered for how he lived.
Pallbearers carried Staff Sergeant Edmund Lowe to his grave at a military funeral in Salem, New Hampshire. He was 23 years old. For NPR News, I'm Cheryl Rich Kern.
Paying with plastic isn't what it used to be. For the first time, Americans are spending more money on debit cards than credit. With debit cards, consumers are paying with money they have, not money they're borrowing, a positive thing in these debt-averse times. But as NPR's Martin Costi reports, the debit card's growing dominance means Americans need to learn a new set of rules.
You might remember this Visa commercial from a few years back. The scene is a deli where customers and clerks juggle orders in a perfectly synchronized ballet of commerce. What keeps things running so smoothly? Why, everyone's paying with a debit card, of course.
Because money shouldn't slow you down. Life takes faster money. Life takes Visa.
That commercial is rapidly becoming reality. Last year, for the first time, spending on Visa logo debit cards overtook spending on Visa credit cards. Not just the number of transactions, but also the total dollars spent.
You go to the grocery store and, you know, 10 years ago, maybe I would have written a check to pay for things at Trader Joe's, but now I use a debit card.
Anita Ramasastry is a former Federal Reserve lawyer. Now she's at the University of Washington Law School, where she specializes in payment systems. She says younger consumers especially have embraced the debit card, in part because it looks so familiar.
It looks pretty much like a credit card. Would you agree? Yeah?
Definitely.
The fact that a debit card has the same kind of number as a credit card means it can be used to buy things, in person with a PIN code or signature, or if you go online without a PIN or signature. On some websites, that debit card number plus the expiration date is enough to buy you, say, a new TV, just like a credit card. But in cases of fraud, the two kinds of card are not identical.
With credit cards, by law, my maximum liability for an unauthorized transaction is $50. For debit cards, it's a more tiered structure.
Time is a factor. The longer you take to report fraud on your debit card, the less money you're guaranteed to get back. When it comes to debit cards, the law is simply less forgiving, something Ramasastry says doesn't make much sense, since people use the two kinds of card interchangeably. In practice, many banks do offer credit card-style fraud protection on their debit cards. Bill Sheedy, president of Visa North America, says that's the case for cards bearing his company's logo.
We have provided to consumers of Visa debit cards or credit cards a higher level of protection, and the requirements for our issuers who issue those cards to consumers is that they provide zero liability and immediate credit to consumers if there is a dispute.
But that extra protection for debit cards is voluntary. Groups like Consumers Union say it's time to put the industry's best protections into law. At Visa, Bill Sheedy doesn't think consumers are that worried.
The trends are clear. The consumers and merchants want to transact in an electronic form, and we think Visa debit is a big part of that.
Still, not everybody's on board with debit cards. Remember that commercial? It culminates with a disaster at the cash register when one poor schlub fails to produce the expected debit card. Dave Ahrens remembers that scene.
The guy who slows everybody down is the one paying cash.
That's you.
That's me, always.
Ahrens just paid cash for a tea at a Seattle Starbucks, and he sits down to explain why it is he won't allow his bank to create a debit card in his name.
I work in information technology, and I can tell you that it's really tough for somebody to ensure that your data is going to be handled properly.
He just doesn't see the need for that 16-digit number to exist, especially if somebody might use it to clean out his bank account. He prefers to get his cash from the teller in person once a week. In these austere times, he says, there's nothing better than a wad of cash to help you keep track of your spending. Martin Costi, NPR News.
To read more about the differences between debit and credit cards, go to npr.org.